This is AC2GS, the Kings County Radio Club. Technical net will begin in 5 minutes.
Kilo Golf 2 Charlie standing by and listening.
Kilo Yankee 2 Michael Yankee standing by for the net.
Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Malen, KG2C, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our own answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. In addition, we offer original articles and reviews of many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder in as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type. But if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. In addition, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to live.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Malen KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the words comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experience to us all. If you would like to contact the hosts of this TechNet, or would you like to submit a question for the next TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Malen KG2C. Good evening, Malen.
Good evening, Roy, and everyone else on the net. This is Malen, Kilo Golf 2 Charlie. Very glad to be here and looking forward to hearing your questions tonight and listening to Roy's explanations. Back to net control from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Very good, Malen. Well, I will open up this session of our Kings County Radio Club technical net. Please, people out there who have any questions or comments for the net, give us your call sign and your name and whether you have a question or a comment.
Aaron, KB2ZGA with a question.
Anyone else care to offer a question or a comment for this week's episode of the Technical Net?
Net Control. Net Control, KC2WTA, question.
Aaron, KB2ZGA, question.
Okay, recognize Aaron, recognize Joe. Anyone else want to put their name down before we get this thing in gear?
Hello, to Japan Victor X-Ray, Lloyd.
Aaron, KB2ZGA, with a question.
Yes, Aaron, you are recognized. You are first on the list. Lloyd, do you have a question or a comment tonight? I just want to write it down so I know what's coming in the future.
Sorry, question.
Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, question.
JT2, TRX, Dan, Manhattan, with a question.
Aaron, KB2ZGA, with a question.
Okay, Aaron, you're the most enthusiastic. I think you've given your name four times now, so you're the first up. Please, Aaron, what is your question tonight?
Okay, thanks for taking it. I wasn't sure if I'm hitting the repeater or not. I wasn't getting the tone back. New to the club, fairly new to amateur, even though I've been licensed for years. It's a question about RFI interference. I have a HF station that I have at a house, and mostly used for data with a signal link, and I'm getting interference occasionally on the phone, which is a VoIP phone, like right near the radio, and also on the computer screen when it transmits data. I have a antenna about 40 and a 20 meter. It's a multi-band antenna, alpha delta antenna, about 40 feet high, making worldwide contacts. It's working fine, but I just have this issue with interference. And just want to put in two more comments. The antenna is pretty much clear. Towards the end of the antenna, I have an AC unit on the roof. It's a dipole. The AC is about 5 feet away from the antenna. And the second thing is the radio station is not grounded because I am on the second floor of a house. I don't really have access to any pipes. Wondering if that can be the issue. So any of your comments for it would be appreciated. Over.
Very good. Let me ask you what might be the million-dollar question. Do you have a ballon connected to your antenna?
No, I do not. It does not need one. It's just a coax going up. It's a type that does not need. They specifically say that they do not need the ballon. I have about a 100-foot coax cable that goes up there. Over.
Okay. Do you have a brand name or a model number or any information on that particular antenna that says it doesn't need a ballon?
Yes, it's the Alpha Delta. Alpha Delta, I think it's the 40 meter, 10 to 40 meter Alpha Delta antenna. I guess you can Google that.
Well, I don't really need to Google it. I assume you have the DXCC.
Roy, the DXCC is up to 80 meters. He has the shortened version out up to 40 meters.
Perfect.
Okay, what model is that then?
40, and I only use it on 40 and 20.
So what I have a DXD, and that goes to 80 because it has a loading coil. I thought that the CC goes up to 40, and it too has a loading coil, but for the 20 element to 40. Am I mistaken in that?
No, that's correct. The length is for a 20 meter length, and then there's a coil, and then an extra couple of feet. So the total length of this is about 40 something feet. And I say again, it works great. Worldwide communication, data worldwide. Just this occasionally getting this interference, and it's just occasionally. I'm thinking if the grounding is not the issue, I'm thinking maybe the signaling might be the signaling and the computer involved might have to do with it. Over.
Or he has the DX Echo Echo, which is 40 feet.
Okay, very good. Now, I mean, it might be that there's a shielding problem with some of your equipment, and if you were able to ground it in some way, it probably would be less sensitive to RF issues, but I'm not sure exactly why. I don't recall reading anything in Alpha Delta's disillusioning people against the ballons. In point of fact, a ballon is a very interesting device. It's a transformer that connects a balanced circuits to unbalanced circuits. And your dipole is pretty much a balanced antenna, and your coaxial cable is an unbalanced transmission line. So it would seem to be the perfect use for a ballon. Now, you don't need an impedance transforming ballon, a 4-to-1 or a 9-to-1, because the impedance of the dipole is approximately 50 ohms. But you probably would do well with a 1-to-1, or sometimes called an RF choke. That will limit some common mode RF getting down into your coaxial line and getting into your shack. So it might be as simple as getting either a poor man's ballon, which is taking a coaxial cable and coiling it in about 7 or 8 turns, about 6 or 7 or 8 inches in diameter, and tying it up that way. Or you could use a W2TU ballon, which is basically a row of about 8 ferrite clamps, put one on end of each other towards the feed line, and then usually a heat shrink tubing to kind of weatherproof it for the outside. But I think you should consider an RF choke for that. I mean, that might not be the final solution, but I think it might help you.
Amen. Okay, Roy, that sounds like a great advice. Just I do remember seeing those 8 turns of the coax cable. I didn't quite understand them. Now that you've explained it, what was the last model that you mentioned? You said RF choke, but you mentioned something W2DU.
Yes, it's named after a silent key who wrote a lot about it. His call sign was W2DU, and you'll recognize it when you see the picture. It's really, all you do is you take about 6 or 7 RF clamps, the ferrite clamps that you could snap onto a cable, and you put them end to end, and then you physically secure them so that they don't slide around. And that's the method that I use on my DX fan dipole. I have a W2DU ballon, and it works very nice. I had a little bit of issues with RF when I couldn't raise the legs of the dipole high enough because of a tree issue, but once I trimmed the tree and got it up to a higher angle, all the RF disappeared from my shack. So keep those two options in mind. Of course, you could also buy the more expensive ballons if you like sturdy boxes. DX Engineering, and there's Ballon Designs that sell ballons. All you have to make sure is that it's a one-to-one ballon. You don't want a impedance transforming ballon for your dipole.
Okay, and last but not least, is there anything I can do to ground it if I'm not near a pipe? Like, there's no point in using the ground of the electric, right?
Yeah, I would suggest against using the power conduits ground connection for a ground. So there's no pipe, there's nothing around you, eh? Nothing at all?
No, it's basically one of the small bedrooms that are used as a shack right now, so not near a bathroom or anything, nothing accessible anyways.
But what about radiator? What kind of heat do you get?
Oh, we have radiators here, yep, we do.
Well, I assume it's hot water or steam?
Think of that, but yeah, the radiators is definitely a pipe going down. So we'll give that a shot. Sounds good.
Yeah, I think that's it's not as good as a cold water pipe, or even better, a ground rod that's just banged into the ground. You might even be able to get away with an external ground rod, even though you are on the second floor. If you use some copper strapping that's wide enough, you might kind of get the impedance down. The problem with grounding from above, say, the first floor, is that there's a inductive impedance in your ground strapping. You can minimize that by using a wide copper strapping to a degree. But, you use what you got. But I would consider the radiator pipe. I don't know exactly whether you're in the front of the house and the rear of the house, but you still might be able to finagle a copper strapping. I mean, although my shack is on the first floor, I have a slightly sunken basement, so it's really on the first 1.5 floor. And I have a nice big wide copper strapping going to ground outside in the backyard.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you so much for this great advice. And this is my first of many more nets that we'll be on together. So thank you so much, Roy, and this has been answered, and I'll give all of these a shot. I'll be clear with my question.
Someone replied with a very noisy signal. If they could try again, if they could kind of move their antenna around or somehow improve their signal, that would be appreciated.
Kilo Golf to Charlie with a comment.
Sure, comment away.
Do you hear me better now? Because I was the one with the noisy signal, I guess.
No, I doubled you, but Milen.
Milen, I don't know. It was a little blip of something. I don't know what happened there.
Do you hear me now, or is there a problem with my transmission?
I hear you perfectly, Milen. Don't worry about it.
Okay, I know. Maybe I dabbled with someone. Well, I wanted to mention on the subjects of balun, I have tried the MFJ-915, which is the type of balun you were describing, the W2DU kind of balun, which is basically a coax with the ferrites around it, and it's enclosed in a PVC pipe with connectors and everything. So you can buy that pretty cheap off eBay if you want. But the cheapest way, actually, especially if you're going to have several lines, is to just buy the ferrites themselves. For me, I just bought them from arrow.com, but there are a lot of other suppliers. Some are cheap, for some more expensive. When you're buying in bulk, I think, at least at the time when I looked, Arrow seemed to have the cheapest prices, and also they offered free shipping, I think, over $25 orders. So that worked well for me, but there's other places to check out for prices. If you want to build something yourself, or you just want to clamp something onto the coax you're using, KiloGolf to Charlie, back to net.
Yes, very good advice. I would suggest that if you do get the chokes and put them together yourself, which is fine, it's basically what I did for one of mine, that you do some little extra with, get some heat shrink with glue inside tubing and use that to seal it up so it'll keep it in place so it doesn't ride and it's not exposed to the elements quite as much.
Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, question, comment?
Okay, give us your comment, Gene.
Regarding the grounding, RF grounding, on my AM, the actual RF grounding is internally grounded with the negative, and negative on positive is grounded to the house ground. So in theory, they're all grounded together.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you did, but I have nothing against, say, grounding, having a separate RF ground and then bonding the RF ground at the ground to your electrical conduit ground that's at the ground. The problem is doing it when it's being tapped on the second floor of a house where the ground connection is a distance away from the original earth grounding.
You're saying that my amp has internally grounded the RF ground to the negative power connection on the amp itself. That's why you plug it in, it's still grounded. And I also have a ground rod outside, too.
Okay, but the important thing is the ground rod outside, because if there's any kind of a difference, that'll offset it. It's just that most people have found that it's not a reliable RF ground, the one in the electrical outlet, because of the vagaries of the wiring. It's going through the wall. You don't know what the distance is. And the longer a ground wire exists, the more the inductance of it exists, and with it the impedance. And so although it's fine for DC or even 60-cycle AC or megahertz of RF, it has a much higher impedance and effectively isn't properly grounded.
Okay.
Anyone else with any comments on the subject or questions on the subject?
Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Yes, Milad.
Well, I wanted to make a safety comment. If you are considering adding your own ground rod, whether it is to make usage of the grounding bolts on the back of most amateur radio equipment or for lightning safety, please check what the National Electrical Code has to say for this sort of stuff. If I remember correctly, the minimum required wire gauge is 10 for connecting your additional grounds to the house electrical panel ground, and they do have to be all connected according to the NEC, and I think that's also a requirement following it if you are expecting any sort of payment from your insurance company. So familiarize yourself with that sort of stuff, and you know how to implement it. There's a lot of discussion on the internet, much of it wrong, unfortunately. The ARRL also has a book that covers these topics. I would recommend you get it. I haven't got it yet, but I intend to once I may beef up my station here, because right now when there's a storm, I just don't have any cables coming inside the house at all, basically. I just disconnect the cables, and there's just antennas connected to nothing outside. So that's my approach until I get something better installed. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to net.
Well, yeah, the safest approach is to disconnect everything and leave a good gap around it because, you know, unfortunately, lightning is tricky. It can jump across, open contacts and such. But it's a very good book from the ARRL. I have it. I've read it. It also suggests other books on basic electrical circuits in houses, which is also a nice informative book. And there's a lot of arguments out there on the HF bands of the proper way of grounding, multi-bonding, single bonding, whether you should screw the connection in, whether you should solder the connection in, whether you should thermite compound the connection from a piece of wire or a piece of strapping to a ground rod. So it's a fascinating thing, and it's one of the things that we seem to come back to repeatedly because it's such an important thing, and it's not obvious. So, I agree. Great book of the ARRL. I think it's something that belongs in most people's library. Anyone else with any kind of questions or comments upon this subject before we move on to the next question?
82NNZ. Same topic for your next
Is it the same exact topic, or is it just another question?
It's actually the same topic in regard to RF noise. I have an off-center dipole on the roof, I have about 25 feet between that and the wires coming into the house and a large transformer. And the noise I get is horrendous. I have tried to go on a 10-meter net. I think the land runs that. And I was just listening up and the suggestions that you had for the ferrite piece.
Well, yeah. But in your case, it might be something different. If you're saying, are you talking about a power transformer there?
Yeah. Roy, the houses are tight here in New Park, and I have an inverted dipole. It's about 10 feet off the roof, and it goes down side to side and east to west as far as facing wave propagation. And the lines in the back of the house are about 30 feet away, and they're parallel to the dipole. And I have everything grounded as best I can. The station's grounded. The RF is grounded to a rod outside, and it's also tied into the main house ground, so I did everything as best I could as per normal grounding.
Okay, but the question that I'm kind of thinking of is you might have a noisy transformer. Occasionally, power transformers begin to fail. They're not supposed to spew RFI. When they start to fail, though, they start to make these buzzing and clicking noises, and they can spark sometimes, and they can spew a lot of RF. And if you could document any of that going on, it probably you can cajole the power company into fixing it because they don't want half-broken equipment on their system anyway. So it's just a matter of documenting it and knowing the right guy to complain to. So if you think it might be the transformer, you might want to focus in on the transformer and see if you can kind of document any kind of RF coming from that direction.
Okay, roger that, Roy. Thanks for the suggestion. Like I said, it's about 30 feet from the antenna where it's mounted. And I don't know what the likelihood of asking PSE&G to move a transformer is or fix it, but I guess I can go that route. I've tried everything else with ferrites, and the dipole I have is an offset, so it's got a balun built in. So I'm at my wit's end. I'm trying to get on HF. Thanks for the suggestion.
You're welcome. I seem to remember MFJ even sells a parabolic device that is kind of designed to kind of point at these transformers to see if you could pick up the hum that is kind of a trademark of a malfunctioning transformer. But, you know, at the very least, you could do a little Google search for it. I'm sure there's lots of examples because I've heard people complain, and I've heard victory stories where they cajole the guys into coming by and replacing the transformer, and I've heard not quite victory stories. But does anyone else have any kind of comments or questions about this subject and about NNZ's problem there.
Okay.
I guess we exhausted that for today, but I'm sure it'll come back because it's a very popular question. Next on the roster is KC2WTA, Joe. What question do you have for us today, Joe?
Hey, good evening, Roy. I just jumped in with a question because there was such a long time passed between the time you called for check-ins, and I thought we were going to have one of those nights where nobody answered up. But I have a question, though. It's about what we talked about a few months ago. What is the mix that's used for the ferrite chokes for ham radio?
Well, I mean, there's a number of ferrite mixes depending upon the frequencies that you plan to use, and the go-to mix that most people will suggest, and like anything's in ham radio, you'll find guys who poo-poo it and say that it's the worst thing, is mix number 31. There are other mixes if you stay really in the low frequency amateur band. There might be somewhat better ones if you move up into the higher, but the best compromise mix for HF use is mix 31. If anyone else has any favorite mixes, please feel free to offer them. Well, I guess mix 31 is the favorite mix. Are you familiar with that mix, Joe?
No, I had read that there are different mixes. You know, back then when we were discussing this, you told me I should try them, and I just bought any ones that I saw on eBay. I actually bought them for size. I think they were 3mm and 7mm for the different size coax, and it worked. I have to. I bought a box of 10 each, so I have to go back and look at the boxes and see if they're marked for the mix. I paid no attention to that at all. I just bought strictly for size.
Okay, so you played a little Russian roulette, and fortunately you won. It's a very popular mix, so I guess that was just what they were offering, and you were very fortunate. There are somewhat esoteric mixes out there that would just not work terribly well. It wouldn't be obvious to anyone. It's just the impedance. The way that all these things work is they increase the impedance of the outer shield. So if you increase the impedance enough, you decrease the common mode flow of it, of the RF that comes back. And so if you use a core that's not really well designed for the frequency, it just won't give you enough impedance, enough resistive quality to block much in the way of a signal. So you got lucky. What can I tell you, Joe? It's good to be lucky.
WA2CDL Mobile.
Hello, Andy. What do you have to say, Andy?
Oh, how you doing? I just turned it on. Do you hear me okay? Because I'm not from home.
Yes, you're a little noisy. You're about 15% noise, but otherwise you're fine.
The repeater sounds good. I wonder what's happening with it. It's been a while. So I'm gathering when you as soon as you mentioned mix, I'm assuming you're talking about toroidal cores and the type of material that they make the core with in regard to the mix of the core. Is that right?
That is quite correct, and we're back at the DR1X repeater. We're waiting for them to repair the DR2X and make it compatible with our controller. So that's what we're on, the DR1X, without a Arkham controller board. I spoke too soon. You're breaking up now.
Well, I'm pretty far away. What about the amplifier? Is the amp in the line?
I believe so.
Yes, and to RGA.
Okay, I think, is that Mitch?
Yes, it's in line. Everything's hooked up except for the control.
You got the amplifier fixed up, I gather.
Yeah, it wasn't the amp, it was the power supply.
I missed what you said. Power supply?
Yep.
So it wasn't the amp at all, it was the power supply. Okay, that's good. All right, I didn't mean to break up the queue, so I wanted to say hello to you guys, Roy. But I'm not too familiar with the mixes of the toroids. Doesn't mix determine the permeability of the core, which in turn affects, you know, the inductance of the toroid itself? You know, how much inductance towards given the size of the core, how much inductance it would have, which of course, you know, affects the which is in relation to the ductive reactants, but how much inductance it is, and depending on the inductance of the core, if it's a higher inductance at the frequency that it's being used at, it would prevent any from going past that core. If you copy what I'm saying, am I saying this correctly?
Yes, Andy. The different mixes have both different permeability and they also have different saturation rates. So that's the important thing as well. If you saturate a choke's material too low power, then the rest of the power isn't going to be effective, and the total impedance that adds to the common mode conduction is going to be less, and so you'll end up with a lot more common mode emissions going down into your shack. So it's a combination of permeability of the material and the saturation point for each of the different frequencies.
We'll go to Charlie.
Makes sense. And I guess it's also to determine the handling capability, how much power, RF power, is input through this particular. Physical size of the core. My understanding also that if a core saturates, or if you have any magnetic material or something related to that saturates, that's going to produce harmonics as it normally does, and that harmonic content. The harmonic content of the produce harmonics and interference. I'm looking for that would introduce more interference to the radio that is being used on. And I'm saying that too.
Yeah, if you saturate the ferrites too much, you get them past 100%, they stop being linear devices, and when you expose RF to anything that's nonlinear, you produce harmonics and all matter of problems. And also the power handling is another factor, but usually you just upscale the quantity of the ferrite. Yeah, obviously, if you're throwing full legal power into a coax, you don't get the thinnest ferrite chokes imaginable, because if there's a lot of common mode current going down, you're going to basically bake the mix. And unfortunately, they're not very tolerant of being heated beyond a certain point. They can degrade both physically and cause it to crack or chatter, or they can just degrade the mix invisibly and they just wouldn't be functioning too well.
AC2TRX, can you read me, Roy?
Yes, I can read you. Yes, TRX, I can read you.
Thank you. I've got a question when my turn comes.
Okay, we have you on the launch pad. I think Milen wanted to make a comment about this.
Yes, Kilo Golf to Charlie with a comment. Very good book that's available for free online on this topic for anyone who's interested in learning more about it. It's called A Ham's Guide to RFI Ferrites Balance and something else. It's published on the Audio Systems Group website, audiosystemsgroup.com/rfi-ham.pdf. You can easily find it with a Google search. It discusses this topic in depth, and also the guy did some research with measurements, actually, on different ferrites and what they do and how to use them, with practical suggestions, not just the experiments that he ran. But to summarize, basically, if you are concerned mostly about HF, MiX 31, as Roy mentioned, will cover you between 1 and 300 megahertz for common mode suppression. MiX 43 will also work, but not as well for 31 on the lower bands. So it's more suitable for up from 25 megahertz and up to 300. So if you're only interested in VHF, maybe that will be more suitable. And then MiX 61, which is very, very rarely used, actually, that will cover you from 200 to 2,000 megahertz. So if you're doing VHF, UHF, that's one way to do it, although the more common is actually to do the common mode suppression as part of the antenna matching at those frequencies. At least, especially in Yagi's, it's usually incorporated in the match itself without using those cores. At least from my research on it, that's what I learned. So for most HF, MiX 31 is what you need. And if you're running more power, rather than having more turns through the ferrite, just add more ferrites in series along your coax as a W2DU balance, basically. And that will improve the power handling capability of your choke. Kilogolf to Charlie, back to net.
Thank you very much, Milan. There's also another option. Some people do it. They'll take a few loops of coaxial cable, and they'll loop it around one or two cores, trying to save the number of cores. But I think that's penny wise, pound foolish. Cores don't really, the toroid chokes don't cost that much, and if you put more of them, they'll tolerate more power bursts than if you use one or two. But that's another option. A lot of people go for the ugly Balun. I think that really depends upon how cheap your coaxial cable is. You know, for runs of LMR 400, that could run into a couple of bucks. So I tend to like the W2DU. So I assume we answered your question, NNZ. Did we answer your question as well, WTA?
Yes, Roy. Thanks very much. KC2, WTA.
KD2NNZ. Yeah, Roy, I'm going to try the chokes and see if I have any luck with that, in addition to scoping out that transformer and see if that's the culprit. Thanks very much, Roy, and I'll be standing by, listening up. KD2NNZ, George here in New Ipoch.
Very good, and you're always welcome back, and I'm sure there are other questions that will pop up in your mind down the road, so we'll talk to you somewhere down there. Next on our list is Lloyd. Good evening, Lloyd. What's your question for tonight?
Good evening, Roy. I have a question for Kilo Golf to Charlie, K2JVX here, and it pertains to WSJTX, okay?
That's fine. Milan uses that program a lot, and he has a lot of experience. So take it away.
Milan, I'm having problems with the settings on the spectrum graph that accompanies the program. And on the lower left, there's three settings. One of them is the compression, and then the offset, and the average. And I was wondering what settings that you find most optimal. I understand that it might vary by PC, but at least it would be a start, because I can't ever make the graph give me any kind of beneficial information. So maybe you could tell me what settings you use that you like.
Well, first of all, do you see and decode signals, just to make sure that your audio is correctly connected? That's the first thing. Then the second thing is to set your audio levels, which in the new version, by the way, is no longer part of the WSJT software. It used to be controlled with a slider. They removed that. Now you're supposed to do it from your computer. So you basically go to your, if you look in the lower right corner, assuming you're running Windows, click on the speaker icon, right click, and then select playback devices. Find the sound card that you're using, where you have your radio connected. Click on it, click on properties, and you can set the levels there so that, and the recommended, I think, is for that volume bar to be around midway, around 50% in the WSJT software when you actually have signals. Have you done this?
That wasn't my question. My question is the settings on the wide graph. There's three choices. You know, there's selections on the left side: the compression factor, the frequency at left edge of waterfall, and the number of FFT averaged. And I don't know what those settings should be to get an optimal result on the graph.
Okay, let me open the software and I'll read it to you. I cannot open it and read it because it will change my frequency on the radio as soon as I open it. So let me read it. I'll come back to you in just a moment.
Copy that.
I'll tell you what, as long as we have this pause, let me do our little commercial and not waste any time. Okay?
Let me, if you want.
This net is brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, November 1st, sometime after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, which, much like this net, lasts from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We also have a weekly Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology net every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater. If you have the ability to communicate using Fusion technology, you are urged to join. We are offering an analog audio internet stream to follow along with the FusionNet traffic at fusion.kc2rc.com. Hopefully that will be operational real soon. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, please address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com. or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. And now, back to the show.
Okay, thank you, Roy. I did load the settings, and I'll mention what I've set each of them to and why I have set it that way, because I do change them from time to time, depending on what mode I do. So the first setting there is bins per pixel. I use value of 3 there, and this basically determines how the horizontal resolution of your graph. And I've set it to that, because it fits the other windows best. It's not critical for any decoding. It just fits the arrangement of the other windows that I have as I've arranged them on my screen. So it's completely personal preference. Then the end averaging, I used 2 for ST8, and I think I used 5 when I use JD65. That just determines how fast the waterfall will scroll. So it's purely up to personal preference. Does not determine anything really for the functioning of the software. The start of my graph is at 50 hertz. I used to use 200 hertz on my previous radio, which kind of had problems with the edges. So the first 200 hertz were kind of noisy and not very linear when I tried to transmit or when I tried to listen to stuff there. So I was cutting off the first 200 hertz before. Now I'm only cutting off the first 50 hertz because the ICOM 7100 that I use doesn't have this problem at all. I could start it at 0 hertz if I wanted. It will still decode everything that is heard by the computer. It's just where you start the graph. So again, does not change anything regarding decoding. Say at 200 hertz, the software would still decode below that. Let me drop. Palette is on default. The setting before it is on default. To the right, I have flattened checked, and below that, I have selected cumulative. Our reference spec is unchecked and the sliders are in the middle. And then spec is 30%. I don't remember what that does, and smooth is set to 1 and doesn't seem to be changeable in the older version that I'm using. I haven't updated in a while. They might have changed something, but this is what I have right now.
Thank you. I copy that. So basically, if I set it to that, I just get one fat orange line. I don't get the individual frequencies. What do you suppose is up with that?
Sorry, can you say again what you get?
The giant fat orange line that spans maybe 1,000 cycles.
Well, did you try to listen, you know, on your computer? You can listen to, because obviously I'm assuming your radio is connected to the computer and is acting as a microphone. You can connect that microphone to your speakers and actually listen to what your computer is getting and hear if you have this. Maybe there's some hum or something in the connection. Usually the best connection is done when the radio has a built-in sound card. Any other cabling and interfaces could, you know, add noise to this stuff. So try to listen to hear what might be causing this line. Because if you see a line, the computer has that line as a signal. You know, it's a genuine signal that you're hearing. And try to determine if it's from your own cabling or the radio is receiving. So you obviously can listen to the radio, what it's getting, but also listen to what the computer is getting.
Well, I'm receiving signals. I'm able to, and I'm using FT8, and I can send and receive. I'm getting a pretty robust decode right now, but when I look at the spectrum graph, it's just not giving me a clear indication of the various frequencies.
Well, you have that orange line. If it's a very strong signal, basically that's the only thing that you're going to see. And even though the computer hears and decodes the other stations, they're not going to be drawn because it's all relative to the strongest signal. That's why you have to set the levels. But one way to test this, where this strong signal is coming from, move to another frequency by just changing the frequency on your radio. See if you still have that line, because if you still have it in the same place, it might just be something from your computer or your cabling picking up something that it shouldn't be picking up. Compare what you hear from the radio to what the computer hears to the radio, because you could have an issue with the cabling.
I'm taking an audio as opposed to digital output from my radio. Do you think I need a choke on the audio line?
Wait, but how have you connected the radio? Just directly with the audio cable to the computer?
Correct. And then the output, though, I'm using the USB because I'm using my radio that I operate. It is a 7100, but I'm operating over the internet. So I can't use the digital. I can only use the audio out.
Well, I'm trying to think about it. Because if you're using the ICOM 7100, you have in and out as a sound card to the computer, and that would be the best way to do it. Now, if you just use the audio cable, you have to make sure it's impedance matched. You have to make sure it's properly shielded, ideally opto-isolated, unless it's, you know, you use a box that has all of these, you're probably going to have a problem. And that line is probably the result of that. At least when I first tested it, that's pretty much, I didn't have just one line, I had a bunch of lines. And I quickly bought the opto-isolated cable for my previous radio. And that obviously solved that issue. So if you have a 7100, try to set it up so you use the USB sound in and out of it. There are settings in the radio where you can select for which modes. For example, for SSB data or just regular SSB, whether to use the microphone or the data cable or the accessory port, and you should be able to set up for whatever mode you use to use the USB sound for that.
I haven't played around with that, but the output I can't, because the digital output from the radio comes from the box, not the head. and I only have the head and the box somewhere else because I'm operating over the internet. That's why I have to use strictly an audio signal.
But if you operate over the internet, I'm assuming there's some computer involved in all of this. If the radio is connected to that computer, why don't you run WSGT on that computer and just remote desktop into that computer over the internet and control it? That way the WSGT will be local to the radio. There will be no latency between the two of them. So you're removing that problem as well, actually, which could be an issue later on with the time, and you will be able to use the USB connections as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, except I'm not using software. I'm managing it with remote rig, but the remote rig might have a digital audio output, and I should look into that. I haven't looked into that. That's why I'm connecting to the speaker out from the head end and then going directly into the PC, and that might not be adequate.
Yeah, direct cable connection usually is not adequate unless you're lucky. Usually you have to do either add impedance matching or an opto-isolator, which I guess kind of magically solves that problem. There's people who sell those cables online on eBay. I bought a cable like that before for my older radio. It worked well. And that's what you could try if you're operating. Position basically or setup requires you to use the audio cables instead of the USB cable. I would still recommend trying to do it over USB somehow. There are ways, I don't know how well they work, to forward USB traffic over the internet, and I'm sure there's ways. Well, but everything would involve a computer, actually. You seem to want to eliminate the computer from it. I guess that makes it a bit difficult. But if you're using WSJT, I guess you do have a computer on one end at least. If you have computers on both ends, you know, you have more flexibility in terms of which software you run on which end and what you can forward from one computer to the other. I guess the cheapest and easiest way is not to change your operating style too much and just add an opto-isolated cable or an impedance match cable, and that should take care of that line.
I appreciate that. I'm going to try that, but just FYI, as a side note, there's a comment, not a question. The reason why I'm using remote rig is because if I used a PC at the other end, it's not fault tolerant. So if there's a power failure and then it reboots, it's not going to come. It's just not going to. Even if I set it up to automatically load WSJT, et cetera, it's still not going to function properly. Whereas the remote rig is fault tolerant and comes back to life, and it's pretty nifty in that regard.
Okay, that's nice. Well, what I know from reading the Flex forums mostly, what people do is they usually add internet control power switches and also power relays that they can control over the internet. So they would have a power switch for their power supply, the 12-volt power supply for all of their radio equipment, so they could turn that on and off in an emergency. And they would also have power relays to control various pieces of equipment on and off individually, because some pieces of equipment have a way of turning them on and off, not just by applying power, obviously, but, you know, as a power on and off command by the relay, or, you know, to just switch on and off their power using their relay. So that's, I think, what people usually end up doing when they operate a lot remotely. Although, I guess, what you're using also works in is certainly simpler to implement than setting up all those relays and remote power switches and stuff like that. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to net.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Milan, and thank you, Lloyd. I don't know. I'm a little bit confused about if it was that much of a problem, I would assume he wouldn't be able to decode the signals. He seems to be able to decode the signals. It's simply that he doesn't seem to be able to get it to display the spectrum on the screen. Is that what's going on, or am I missing something?
Kilo 2, Juliet Victor X-ray. Yes, that is correct, exactly what you said. And what I think is interesting about it is it might be the magic of the WSJT decoding, because, you know, if you use the speaker on the radio and then the and a microphone and put it near the speaker, it'll decode. It'll decode all kinds of bizarre stuff, but I guess the spectrum graph, back to Milan's point, might need a finer audio signal that I'm not giving it, and I might play around with that.
Computer sees this as a signal, it will kind of draw a line somewhere in the middle of your spectrum, and that will be a strong signal there, and all the other signals that it hears from the radio will be relatively weaker signals, but it will still be able to detect them and decode them, basically. His problem is that the graph itself is not being very useful because, you know, you'd like to be able to see this visually so you know where to position yourself, not to interfere with other signals or to find openings between other signals. You know, the whole reason why you use, the spectrum graph in the first place, because otherwise you could get the same data from the software itself, from the decodes. Well, most of the same data, because only the information that's decoded, because there would be faint signals if when things are normally set up that are not decoded, but you could see on the graph, so maybe, you know, you don't interfere with them as well. So that's the benefit of fixing this issue. Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Okay, unfortunately, Milan, you doubled with Lloyd about halfway, half part of your discussion, but I sort of understand, but Lloyd, if you have nothing better to do and have a chance, do a screen grab of the window in question and just email it to me, because I'm curious that way.
I will, happily, and I will send it to you. I'll do it now, and you'll see. And, yeah, I appreciate all the feedback, guys. I mean, this is probably an arcane subject when we put a lot of people to sleep, but it's certainly important, and, it's becoming a very, very, very active mode in these in the nadir of the cycle. So thanks to both of you.
Well, you're quite welcome, Lloyd. And FT8 is very popular for the last month. It's every time I go on those bands, it's always active, that little slice of frequencies. So there's a lot of people using it a lot of the time. So no reason that we shouldn't discuss it. But do you have any other comments, Milan, or anyone else have any comments about FT8 and digital modes? Okay, I heard someone speak for about a tenth of a second, but I didn't get a call sign, I didn't get a name, I didn't get much of anything.
Kilo Charlie 2, November, Golf Uniform, Ralph of Brooklyn.
Hello, Ralph. You have a question for us as well? Because we have a few people still on the list, but if you'd like, I could put you on the list if you have a question.
Yeah, I do have a question. I'm actually in a jam currently, and I do have a question when you're ready, KC2 and GU.
Okay, very good, Ralph. We'll put you on the list. I assume that we've kind of talked out digital modes for the time being. If anyone has any comments, feel free. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next person on our list. Very well. The next person on our list is Gene, AY2MY. What is your question for tonight, Gene?
Thank you, Roy. On this month's QST magazine, I sort of built your own Aurora-based antenna analyzer. Any suggestions or comments on that build?
Yes, I saw it, and it looks very intriguing. It depends upon your level of technical skill and whether you can figure out, if it doesn't work, why it doesn't work. Some people feel comfortable with kits. Others feel comfortable with just a set of instructions. Others feel comfortable with just writing a check. So it really depends upon your level of experience and your curiosity and motivation. But that, you'd certainly save some money that way.
Okay, so I'm not trying to think about building.
Say again, I think you doubled with someone else.
I was thinking about building that, and just was curious to see what people think about the actual this analyzer.
Okay, I mean, for the most part, they could only judge it from reading the article, your opinion is based on the guy who designed it, so it's kind of, you're not going to hear a bunch of yays or nays. This is this guy's baby design, so he's sort of promoting it, although it's very generous of him. If anyone else gets QST, if anyone else has read the article on the do-it-yourself VNA, it looks like a very nice thing. It has, it's a visual VNA, so it gives you pretty pictures and such. If anyone's read the article and has any opinions one way or the other, feel free to throw out your call sign.
WHCDL is back on.
Andy.
You couldn't copy me before when I went into the driveway, so I'm home now. So I just wanted to, you know, say hello and just mention or ask a few things.
Okay, what do you need to ask?
Software-defined radio. A topic that's forever growing and forever to be discussed. I picked up, just to let you know, and not to change the subject too much, but in the realm of digital, when I was up at Nearfest up in New Hampshire, I picked up a bunch of QEX magazines. And that's the Forum for Communications Experimenters magazine, which maybe some of you are familiar with. I know, Roy, you are. QEX is great. They give you great inside information about the latest technologies and what's going on in the digital, analog, and the rest of the world. But I'm seeing more and more articles now on SDR. In fact, I have each one that I have has a page called SDR Simplified. And I never really studied it. And I'd like to know a little bit more about it. Maybe we can have a discussion on SDR and how it's designed and how it works. Because of the fact that some people have SDR radios. I don't, not yet, but I do want to get one. And I want to learn more about it. In particularly, you know, the workings of it and the design of the digital filters and, you know, so on. And there's a lot to it. So what do you think of that as having a discussion, Roy, about that? And we can have an SDR topic, maybe a forum, because I'd like to learn.
AC2TRX with a comment.
TRX.
My question piggybacks on Andy's.
Hey, very good. I just want to make sure that we got through the VNA, because my gut feeling is the most that you're going to get, Gene, is people who've read the article, and it sounds like a great device. It's just, you know, not everyone today, unfortunately, is able to kind of build from components and such. But if you feel comfortable with that, it certainly is a way of saving a couple of bucks and getting a very nice design.
All right, thank you very much. KY2, am I?
Okay, very good. TRX, you have a question that's basically related to Andy CDL's question?
Yes, it is. It's also about SDR. I'm kind of on the threshold of thinking about moving to SDR. I'm using a conventional radio now, very nice, 7600. But I noticed that Plex is coming out with this new 6400M, which is a standalone SDR radio. Looks very interesting. I believe you're a Plex guy. And I guess my question is, what is the advantage from a user's point of view, you know, from the operator, of moving to SDR? I mean, I know it's cheaper to manufacture certain components, but, you know, is there a perceptible difference in, say, receive sensitivity or audio quality or whatever? I mean, what's the general argument in favor of moving up to SDR technology?
AC2GS. That's very similar to Andy N2HUH's question about software-defined radio, what makes it so very special. Depending upon the selection of the design, because not all software-designed radios are the same, you know, you could buy an expensive one or a cheap one. A reasonably expensive software-defined radio tends to have reasonably good receiver specs. There is a list called Sherwood Receivers. Sherwood Labs does tests on receivers and rates receivers from 1 to, I think they're up to something like 250 or something. And if you go on the Sherwood list, the Flex, thankfully, is up there in the high numbers of one of the best in sensitivity and rejection of of other signals and such. So it's not inherent in software-defined radio, the specifications. It's more the design of it that either gets you a good one or a bad one. To go into a whole description of software-defined radio, I'd love to, but it's almost a college course. But if people are interested, I'd be more than welcome to, because you're listening to a Flex 6700 right now, and I happen to like it. One of the features that I tend to like is that it allows your computer to be a surface control device. And you can look at the pan adapters. We'll show you the entire spectrum. I'm looking at all of 2 meters and all of 70 centimeters, and I kind of like to see the lack of activity or the activity. Also, all you needed to do is upgrade the firmware, and you basically have a new radio. So it's very flexible in that almost nothing is built in by hardware. It's all being done by the massaging of 0 and 1 bits on sundry silicon chips inside the radio. So I'm a big fan of it, and I think that's the future technology. ICOM 7300 is a kind of hidden SDR radio, which is very popular and very cost-effective, and they're coming out with a 7610, which is a half-assed, unfortunately, SDR. The SDR, software-defined radio, finagles. What it is ultimately is the antenna goes theoretically straight into an analog-to-digital converter into bits, and then processes the bits from there on. For my Flex, you need to go through some preamplifiers and passband filters. But for the 7610 of ICOMs, it's all old analog equipment until you get to the final IF conversion. And once it gets IF... I might have actually timed this one out. So any comments about what I've said?
Well, that's a good beginning. I agree with Andy. Maybe some kind of special event for SDR would be in order. I'm going to look at the reviews of the new 6400M, which is Flex's new standalone. Apparently, it's going to be released this month or next month, and that looks like a very interesting radio to me. So I'll read some reviews. But thanks for the info, KC2TRX.
Comment? Yes, Milan. I thought you might have a comment on the subject.
Well, I have many comments on the subjects, but I don't want to, you know, drag it into a whole net about software-defined radios and Flex. But regarding the showcasing of that technology, Flex did recently offer amateur radio clubs to organize presentations for them, remote presentations where they would do it over Skype. You know, the club would have a computer with an internet connection and maybe some big screen or projector so everyone can watch, and would you talk to Flex employees over Skype, and they would let you log in remotely into one of their radios and tell you all about its features, and you know, you get to see the software in action. So that's one offer they just published on their forums to any club that's interested, and if there's interest, maybe we could organize this as a club to participate in that program. But also there's a lot of YouTube videos available of people using the software. And, well, my comment regarding this, the software is just part of the story there, because the advantage of having a radio server versus the traditional SDR or radio architectures is that you can really have several types of control to your radio. The knobs and buttons on the radio are obviously the traditional method, but in addition to them, you obviously can control it using a computer or several computers. You can control it with a keyboard, with a mouse, with a MIDI controller, with dedicated additional knobs and buttons, which can be wireless, wired, remote, and all of these control surfaces, actually tablets and phones as well, all these control surfaces can control the radio simultaneously, or at least when that's completely done. They're still working on that, but everything is networked, so each of these devices could send commands and change what the radio is doing. So that flexibility is kind of unique, because with traditional radios, there's not much you can do about how you control it. Sure, you can send CAT commands, but CAT commands don't give you as much flexibility. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to net.
28 something, WHCD.
Sure, Andy. Add away.
Okay, I'm happy that you guys are interested as much as I am because, like I mentioned, we're hearing more about it. But I'm also interested. See, I come from the old school. I'm an old tube man. And, the technology is changing so quickly, it's so hard to keep up with everything that's coming out and everything that's already out there. But listening and reading about, in the digital world, about the sulfate-defined radios and the architecture and how it's designed, I'm interested in talking about that as well. Because just having the basic knowledge of normal super heterodyne receivers with mixing stages and IF stages and so on, this is a completely different scheme using what they call Hilbert transformation filters and FIR filters, which is infinite response. Filters and IQ signals and so on and so forth. So I'm interested in having a discussion about that, about the actual architecture and how it's designed, as well as the receiver itself. So I just wanted to add that. Because I'm reading some of these articles in QEX, and it gets quite in-depth, and you have to really see what's going on. But I want to get some hands-on also to actually, connect build a radio and play with it. So what do you think of that idea, Roy? And getting into a little bit of a deeper discussion over time. Back to you, WHCD.
I think it would be a great idea if we have enough people interested. We could have one of the episodes of the TechNet be that. There's different routes. Sometimes they'll tap the ICOM 7610. They'll tap the final IF transformation, and they'll digitalize it. They'll run it through an IQ demodulator and get two signals that are 90 degrees out of phase with each other. And then, as you mentioned, there are different... It's all done with computers. So gone are all the things that you ever learned about RF, because it's manipulating bits of 0 and 1. There's the IIR, the infinite impulse... response filters, there's the finite impulse response filters, FIR, and those are used to equalize frequencies and do all manner of things just by adding numbers together and crunching them. So it's more like computer science than it is anything that you've ever dealt with radios. So I find it a fascinating, if a little esoteric, subject. But yes, certainly we could do it for one of the episodes if everyone is interested.
Okay, thanks, Roy. That's very good. We'll continue.
Okay, very good. The 6400 was announced. Some will be shipping hopefully in the next month. New orders won't be shipping until early next year. The 7600 is basically two 7400s pushed together. It has two physical receivers in it rather than the 6400's one receiver. And there's two different versions of each. The standard 6400 and 6600 has no display in the front of it, whereas the 6400M and the 6200M, 6400 and 6600M, both have what is a Maestro. Basically, it looks like a tablet front end with a bunch of knobs and dials. So people who like controls and displays can get the M for $1,000 more if they're so inclined.
Comment?
Yes, Milan, comment.
Two more mentions about the M models. The resolution actually is much higher than the master resolution from what I understand. And also they have HDMI ports, whereas the non-M models don't have them. So if you do want the knobs and buttons on the radio, but also want to use a larger screen, for example, if you have vision problems, that's something some hams very much care about, having HDMI ports. So the M models do have those ports on the back, whereas the non-M models, they require a computer.
Kilo Golf 2 Charlie back to net.
Okay, very good. TRX, any other questions about SDR for tonight?
Especially the distinction between the 7610 and the 6400M, because I thought they were both fundamentally SDR radios, but now I hear that
I think someone was doubling with you. It was a very noisy signal.
Sorry, I have trouble getting into this repeater. I was just saying that I didn't realize there was such a distinction between the 7610 and the 6400M. So that's some useful information.
Oh yeah, it's sort of like night and day. I mean, it's an SDR radio, the 7610, but it's kind of one quarter SDR, if you will, rather than what some purists would consider a full, you know, third or fourth generation, because they're also defined by generations. So the first SDRs out there were basically just IF converters, which apparently is what they've decided to do with the 7610, and they're already into third or fourth generation, where they're just feeding stuff almost straight out of the antenna into a digital analog converter. So, you know, the 7610 is disappointing to me. To people who don't particularly like SDR, they'll be thrilled with it because they'll get some features of SDR, not necessarily all of them, but enough to make them happy. And software-controlled radio, by the way, is really different than software-defined radio. It's easier to have a software-defined radio also software-controlled, but that isn't what makes it a software-defined radio. What makes it, by definition, a software-defined radio is that software is doing all of the things that your usual radio, mixing, equalizing, modulating, demodulating, is all done on a computational bit fidgeting type of a phenomena, rather than using chokes and coils and capacitors and condensers and all manner of amplifiers, transistors, and such. So it's a brave new world, and it has a lot of promise for the future, and prices will probably go down, and specs will probably go up, and eventually I think it will be the future, personally, but we'll see.
Chris, thanks a lot for that information.
Very good. So I guess we'll go to the next and last person on the list, unless someone has something else to say before I move on. Very well. Okay, Ralph, you're up next. What's your question for us?
Just a quick one in general. KC2NGU. The impedance for a Yaesu ST60 or the Yaesu handheld microphone, it says online and in the manuals that it's 200 ohms to 600 kilo ohms or something in that range. But I connect the mic element directly to the PTT/mic pin and ground. The radio doesn't go into transmit, and it used to. And then I check the impedance of a regular microphone that's made for the radio, and it's the same impedance as the microphone I was connecting. So what am I doing wrong? I'm probably emitting a capacitor, I'm assuming. KC2NGU.
Well, I'm not quite sure exactly. I'll probably ask you to explain it again to me. Microphone impedances have gone all over the place in the history of radio. When piezoelectric elements were being used, that's when you had thousands and thousands of ohm impedance. But my assumption would be that the impedance of the microphone that you're using should only be something between 200 and 600 ohms. It really shouldn't be in the kiloohms. That's old technology that probably wouldn't be used. Now, you know, something, you could have burnt out something, and it could be the next question is, as far as that microphone is concerned, is it a dynamic microphone? Is it an electric microphone? Does it have an amplification circuit built into it? You could have fried that. Anything's possible.
No, how do I put it? I bought an MTS 2000 microphone off of a friend who's like having issues, and he's selling his equipment. But the impedance is the same exact impedance as my regular handheld Yaesu microphone for the handheld. And the microphone in the manual says 200 ohms up to 600 ohms, not kilo ohms. But I'm just trying to figure out how come the radio doesn't go into transmit automatically when I connect the two pins across the correct pins, even with the polarity reversed. So I don't get it. What could I possibly be missing? Does the radio, each specific radio needs a certain impedance range, like a tight range, to go into transmit, or am I doing something wrong or something?
Well, the way I have seen most radios, it has nothing to do with impedance. Impedance is a function of the microphone element. What I assume you are trying to trigger is the push-to-talk, which is kind of just a logic. When you take the control wire of push-to-talk and you ground it, it sends a signal to the radio to enable the transmit. So either there's something wrong with the connection, or it's not getting that ground. You're not pulling it to ground. So it has nothing to do with impedances. The push-to-talk button doesn't have particularly an impedance. It's just a ground-open connection.
Okay, because I also ordered a lot of Yaesu plugs off eBay. Those 4-pin Yaesu plugs, I've been making my own plugs with like different kinds of microphones for experimentation. But it goes into transmit when I jump the two wires together for the PCT or microphone in, which is the same pin, and ground. The radio goes into transmit, but when I connect the microphone backwards, it goes into transmit, but when I connect the microphone properly, it doesn't want to transmit. So I'm thinking there's possibly, I'm not sure, that's the thing, KC2NGU.
Well, my guess is when you're reversing things, you're also reversing the push-to-talk button. So instead of grounding the push-to-talk button, you're grounding the microphone button, and the radio has no clue of what you would want to ground the microphone wire for, so it doesn't respond, but that would be my guess.
Okay, but the Yaesu plug, 4-pin plug, has ground, speaker out, data, and speaker, microphone, /PTT, data, and ground. The data pin's not used on the Yaesu microphone. They only use three wires. The PTT switch is normally open, and it connects it to the microphone to transmit. And the speaker is always connected. So that's the thing. I checked the impedance on the stock microphone. The speaker is 9 ohms, which is technically 8. Then the microphone is like, I thought it was going to be 32 ohms, but it's somewhere, it's like 200-something ohms.
Okay, but that wouldn't explain why when you reverse it, it triggers.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out. It's probably the stock microphone has some kind of resistor across it, but I couldn't catch it on the meter. But the regular one I'm using out of a phone, it doesn't have anything across it. So I don't get it, because I know the old style landline phones used to have a resistor to cut down because the volume was too loud, I heard. But I'm just trying to figure out what could I be. I gotta maybe try another radio. That's my best bet.
Yeah, more information is always better. Does anyone out there have any kind of ideas that they could give Ralph for this? Oh, well, I guess not. Well, Ralph, I wish you good luck. And if you figure it out, and even if you don't figure it out, please drop by again and tell us how it turned out. Or if you have any other questions in the future, you know where to find us.
Okay, KC2NGU. For the SDR, I had no luck installing the drivers, because somebody... Tell me in a nutshell, the SDR, you buy the car on eBay, let's say, and how do you get the drivers and all that good stuff? If we could maybe start a mini discussion, if possible. I could wait till next 2 weeks, if possible. KC2NGU.
KC2GS. Well, you know, I mean, if a lot of people want to do an SDR show, we can do an SDR show. I have no problems with that. It depends, with your question, it depends upon which design that you bought. I assume it was an RTL SDR. There are little dongles, and there's other people who kind of sell just knockoffs of it. If that's the case, usually they give you the information, at least the links on the website. There's something called SDR Sharp. You download it, you install it, and then you have to kind of figure out how to get it to work. Usually the biggest problem is loading up the USB driver, but you know, if you try hard enough, usually you find a driver that works, and there are lots and lots of sites that that talk about the RTL SDR. There's actually a manual written by a guy from New Zealand who kind of wrote the book on using these dongles for SDR. And although he has the same last name as me, he's not related. The guy's name is Carl Laufer. And that would be an excellent source material. But I'm assuming that it's an RTL SDR that you're interested in. They usually sell for about $25 or so.
Yeah, but I bought mine maybe 6 years ago, and I have it in the box. It was actually a TV tuner, digital TV tuner, but I know it's an SDR card, in fact. So it came with the driver, CD, and all that, but it's an SDR, but it's advertised as a TV tuner. Me and my friend bought it a long time ago, but that's what I have. I have no idea what it is right now, but I had a lot of issues loading the drivers and all that.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, if you buy something from, if it's 5-6 years ago, it might be a model that's no longer interest to anyone, and so they don't update the drivers, and so you'd have to kind of run it on a Windows XP. All of these SDR dongle things like RTL started life as a digital television devices, converters, for European television. You know, you couldn't use them in the United States, but they sold millions of them in Europe, and someone finally figured out that you could cajole it into making an excellent SDR as long as you kept the frequencies high. They're not really good for HF. They're much better for the frequencies of VHF and above. And you can get some kind of reception on HF, but it's very noisy, and the dynamics are awful. And there are people who actually buy converters to up-convert HF signals so that an RTL dongle is usable. But I don't know. With a price like $20-$25, you're probably better off just buying an up-to-date chipset than hunting down an obsolete chipset, in my opinion.
Comment?
Yes, Milan, comment away.
Oh, I have an RTL SDR, and yes, they are pretty cheap to buy online, especially if you're not too interested into the HF spectrum. They're very actively used on VHF and UHF, especially by people interested in weather satellites and all kinds of satellites, because they're very decent for that. And they are units actually with an additional board that can give you more stability, or that can... frequency stability, I mean, or that can give you HF and proper HF, and usually those have two connectors on them. But once you start getting into those, it might be better to consider one of the other units, which was called, I think, SDR Play was the name of it. It was 100-something bucks, and it really, I think, covers HF and VHF and UHF, and it even has some filtering and additional software. But the RTL SDR will work fine with things like HD SDR, SDR Console, I think, was another. So yeah, SDR Console and SDR Sharp. Those are the three software packages that I use with mine. Kilogolf to Charlie, back to net.
Thank you very much, Milan. The general description of those dongles when they were used for European television, I believe, was DVB. I don't offhand, digital video broadcast probably, but I don't know for sure. Very popular, very inexpensive. Again, I'm not quite sure what version of the chipset is in the device that Ralph has, but my assumption is if it's that difficult to get it to load on a computer, it's probably kind of old. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Oh, I think you are correct, because I did have one of those dongles when I actually lived in Europe, and I used it for watching TV. And I remember when I switched from, I think, Windows 98 or XP to Windows 7, there were no longer drivers for Windows 7 for those older dongles. So you basically had to buy a newer dongle.
Yeah, personally, I think it's well worth the $25 to stick your big toe in the water. I could understand why some people wouldn't want to drop $100 on something that they have no experience with. But, you know, I mean, maybe I'm just wasteful, but I could see betting $20 or $25 on an RTL SDR.
Oh, one more comment?
for a comment away.
You mentioned that they're intended for TV usage originally, and that is true. And because of that, something to note is that they do expect an impedance of 75 ohms, which seems to be the TV standard versus the 50 ohms, which we normally expect in amateur radio. So if you're going to connect it to an antenna, make sure you use the TV kind of coax, that is at 75 ohms, and the suitable connectors for higher frequencies. Not our typical PL259s and RG213 coax and things like that. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to net.
Well, I mean, thankfully, since it's a receiver and not a transmitter, receivers are much more tolerant of impedance mismatches. I think it would laugh off, a little mismatch of 75 ohms to 50 ohms. The big problem I recall them having at one point was all the European dongles had European connectors, which are not any standard connector that you tend to see in the United States. So it was a big pain in the backside to get a proper connector to plug into the other end of that dongle. Some of the newer RTLs have standard SMA connectors, but the older ones had, and I don't even remember what the hell they're called, but they're European connectors of some kind.
Yeah, mine was exactly like that, because as I said, I used it for TV in Europe, and it's not anything I've seen or used other than for that purpose, I think. It definitely was not an SMA connector. And if you just buy a new one now, especially one intended for amateur radio, there's nice packages that give you a small mag mount antenna with a coax cable, a CD with drivers, or at least instructions where to download them, a small booklet that you can download with instructions on how to set things up, and the dongle itself with the SMA connector. And those packages are quite affordable. You can find them on eBay. You can find them on other websites as well.
AC2GS. Yeah, I agree. I say for $20-$25, what the hell? Take the plunge. It's a good introduction into the subject. And if you're so inclined, you could spend a lot of money, as you can with any major hobby, down the road. But it's a very inexpensive ticket to take a look at the world of software-defined radio. Any other questions or comments or statements about this, Ralph?
I don't want to hog it too much, but I'll leave it for the next net. But I could say, just because of the silly custom connectors, I've seen those European ones, you could almost impossibly get an adapter for it. But I've been making my own adapters lately with simple copper tubing with different sizes. I get the used copper tubing, like from an HVAC tech for like ACs and stuff and air conditioners and all. They come in different sizes, even the tiny capillary tubes. I make my own connectors when I could get these extra fittings. So I just wanted to say that. It's very simple. Sometimes I make a coax connector, I crimp the end of the tubing on, and I slightly squish the other end to go onto the connector. And it works pretty well. I just wanted to share that. KC2NGU.
Okay, right, tour.
Well, good for you, Ralph. That's hams are supposed to do things like that. They got those articles of hints and kinks. You should kind of publish something, QST's hints and kinks on that. But you'd be surprised how many poor guys out there just kind of stare at a European antenna connector and they don't even know where to begin with it. But, you know, as Milen mentioned, as I mentioned, the newer RTLs are designed for experimenters, so they have SMA connectors, and there's loads of SMA cables around anywhere. So that shouldn't be a problem. But, I wish you luck on this as well. If anything develops, Ralph, feel free to drop by and tell us how it all turned out.
Q-Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, question?
Yes, Gene, what is your question?
I forgot about a year ago I bought the 5-dash SoftRock RT-TX kit. What do you think about those kits?
Say again?
I bought a kit about a year ago, the stuff. 5-dash SoftRock kits, the transmitter, is that same thing, the software-defined kits?
Yeah, what's the question, though? Where do you get the software for it, or what?
Is it worth building? I reported it, I didn't build it yet.
Well, I mean, my surmise would be, as long as you already bought it, it's certainly worth it, because most people kind of enjoy the experience of building kits, and at the end you'll have something to play with. I don't think that that's out of date, as opposed to a European TV dongle converter that's 5 or 6 years old. So I don't think you'll have a problem getting software to run in it. So I think it would be a good thing to try.
I completely forgot about it. I put it a year ago, and it got out of the radio, and I'm back in. I forgot about it until conversation right now.
Well, it's a good thing that we banged on your memory when you came back with that. Yeah, I mean, we all sort of have things in the back of the closet. I have a couple of little kits that I have never gotten around to putting together. I think we all have, I think it would be an excellent project for you, because software-defined radio, like I said, I really think it's the future. So it's a good thing to kind of get used to now, because, you know, you don't want to be one of those guys with the VCR that flashed 12 for their entire lives.
True, so true.
Okay, any questions, comments, statements, or what have you before we move to the TechNet puzzle for tonight? And I hope everyone has read up on the TechNet puzzle, because it's not really that difficult. It's not tricky at all, and there are no diagrams. Okay, very well. We will go to the TechNet puzzle right now. An HF dipole is fitted with a trap in each leg to permit matching at two different frequencies. The traps should be resonant at, answer A is, higher of the two frequencies to cut off the outer section. B is higher of the two frequencies to include the outer section. C is the lower of the two frequencies to cut off the lower section. And D is the lower of the two frequencies to include the outer section. Now, does anyone want to kind of play along and tell me what they're thinking the answer might be? One of these days I will get a cricket sound effect, I promise all you guys. But until then, does anyone want to play along?
Okay, we'll go to Charlie if no one else wants to.
Okay, well, let me just ask my usual suspect, Joe, WTA. You don't feel in the mood tonight?
No, I'm in the mood. I just got out of the bathroom after shaving. And let me see. I have my computer screen is dark. Nope, back up. Okay. Let me see. I'm going to let it drop. Okay. Let me see. I think it might be the lower of the two frequencies to cut out the outer section, which is answer C.
Okay. There's a kind of logistical problem with that answer. If it cuts out the outer sections at a lower frequency, it means as you lower the frequency, it makes your antenna shorter. Would you really want a shorter antenna for a lower frequency?
Yep, that's right. Well, let me see. So if we want to operate on a higher frequency, the antenna needs to be shorter. And if we resonate the trap at the higher frequency, it'll cut out the outer section. So I guess I'll flip-flop and change my answer to answer A.
Excellent. A is a very good answer. Now, might I suggest why you dismissed D?
Let me see. Answer D, the lower of the two frequencies to include the outer section. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense, too. Let me see. Moving from answer C to answer A, I call the flip-flop. And what would be this? I'm going to change my answer again to answer D. What would that be?
It would be me not being a very good, nice guy. I that was a kind of trick on my part. The way that I look on this question is, just using logic alone, you can pretty much do away with B and C, because They don't follow the laws of physics. You either lengthen the antenna at low frequencies or shorten the antenna at high frequencies. The trick, unfortunately, is knowing how a trap antenna works. And trap antennas are, they act as low bandpass filters. So the answer actually is A, but theoretically you could build a resonant circuit that did the inverse of what everyone else's antenna traps do, and it could be D, but for everyone's antenna dipole traps, the answer is really A, because it's a low bandpass filter that's being used. And low bandpass filters can't be used in the way that D describes them. So A is the answer. You got the right answer, and I kind of tricked you into the wrong answer, and I'm sorry for that, but I thought that it would make it a more interesting teaching example for the rest of the audience. And as always, Joe, I appreciate your participation in this.
That's okay, Roy. That's okay. This is the kind of thing that gets you straightened out. So this is KC2WTA.
KC2GS. Very good. Joe, anyone else have any questions or comments about trapped dipoles, as long as we found ourselves on this subject?
KC2, WTA.
Yes, Joe.
In the answers, answer A and answer D. How would the architecture of the trap be different between the two answers? The theoretical answer for D. How would the trap physically differ from the trap at answer A?
Instead of being designed as a low bandpass filter, it would be designed as a high bandpass filter with a different way of arranging the inductor and the capacitor.
Okay, I'm really just getting with filters myself, different configuration. Would that be in series or parallel, or would it be just a matter of choosing the values for the inductor and the capacitor?
Well, depending upon how many stages the capacitor would be, low bandpass filters have the inductor in series and the capacitor in parallel. High bandpass filters have the capacitor usually in series and the inductors in parallel.
Okay, look, it's easy to visualize that for like an audio circuit. But these are like up in the air, and it's air splices. So how does one orient either the inductor or the capacitor to be in series or parallel?
Well, I mean, usually if you've ever had the joy and privilege of fixing and or cleaning a trap, they are a big pain in the backside. And you can kind of, you remove the outer cover, and there's an obvious inductor coil running across them, and then there's something that's being used as a capacitive plate, and the inductor is connecting both ends of the two elements that are joined in the trap, and the capacitor is not joining both ends, but parallel connected to the inductor that's taking up most of the space. So if you Google antenna traps, they'll probably show you a lot of pictures. Unfortunately, most of them are not pristine. They tend to have a lot of schmutz because a lot of times they're taken when people are fixing them because they break a lot.
Okay, Doc Roy, thanks very much. I have to return to the bathroom and get this shaving cream off my kisser.
Okay, Doc, sorry to interrupt that. Just for the people out there, trap dipoles are interesting things. They're a way to get away with more than one resonant frequency, but as all things, they have their own prices. Trap dipoles tend to be more expensive. They tend to be less efficient because the traps themselves lose power, lose energy, and over time they tend to corrode and you inevitably have to fix them. Plus, unless someone else does it for you, you have to tune it so that it cuts off at the right frequency, because if it doesn't cut off at the right frequency, it doesn't work very well. So So for all you guys out there with trap antennas, I hope you enjoy them, but I'm personally going to stay away from them myself.
Don't you have a DXCC on your roof, Roy? Kilo Golf to Charlie?
Yes, I do, but that's not a trap. There is no capacitor anywhere. It's a loading coil.
Okay, I thought it functioned similarly as a trap. Mine still isn't in the package, actually. I never unpackaged it, so I haven't taken a look at it. I assumed it's some sort of trap that it has there.
Well, no, it there's no capacitor, so it doesn't operate as a trap, thankfully, and requires pretty much no maintenance, as far as I'm aware. I've never heard of anyone particularly complain about having to clean it. It just works. There was a guy on the Limark TechNet who was having all kinds of problems, but I tend to think it was because he was letting both legs of them droop down and near some kind of metallic object that was just wreaking havoc with the signal. But this is not considered a trap. It's considered a loading coil, but I could understand why you would get the two confused.
Okay, thank you for the clarification, Roy. Kilo Golf to Charlie, back to net.
So I assume that everyone is kind of talked out for the night, but I will ask if anyone has any closing comments, statements, questions, or what have you for this episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Anyone out there want to say anything?
K2NNZ, quick question, Roy.
Yeah, sure, question away.
Just to get back to the ferrite coil snap-on. The dipole I have has a 4-to-1 balun under it because it's an offset and it handles multiple bands. The ferrite cores, the snap-ons, the beads would go underneath that balun. Would that be a correct position for those?
Yeah. What's the distance between the antenna feed and your 4-to-1 balun? It should be relatively short.
Roger that, Roy. It's about maybe it's 20 feet down to the entry into the room. I'm on the second floor with my little shack here.
Okay. Any particular reason why you didn't balun it close to the antenna feed?
No, the antenna came with the 4-to-1 balun attached, the multi-band, and I have it set up as an inverted V.
Okay, so it's probably using that length in some resonant mode. So, yeah, you wouldn't want to put a common mode choke on something that's supposed to be radiating on some frequency. So, yeah, you would definitely put the chokes below the 4-to-1 balun.
Okay, Roger that. That would be any particular distance, or just I'm a little confused, yeah.
Well, the higher up the better, because the higher up you block it, the less likely you'll get any significant RF in your shack.
Okay, enough said. I don't want to kill it or torture you any further. KD2NNZ, thanks a lot, Rick.
You're very welcome, and you're not torturing me at all. I, for some odd reason, like to talk about all this stuff. On Sundays, I talk about physics on the Limark TechNet, so a little bit of physics there, a little bit of radio here. You know, I like to talk about these things. But anyway, anyone else have any closing comments, statements, questions, or any kind of things that they need to get off their chest before I roll this up for the night? Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, November 1st, sometime after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have just started a weekly net featuring Jesus Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater KC2RC. If you have the ability to communicate using Fusion technology, you are urged to join. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow AMs join our club. An application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this TechNet or offer a question, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. And as the famous French author Marcel Proust once wrote, "We don't receive wisdom, we must discover it for ourselves after a journey that no one can take for us or spare us." So have fun making your own discoveries, and don't forget to share them with the crowd. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down now, but we'll be back to do it all over again November 8th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially Malen, KG2C. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. This is Roy, Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Good night, guys.
Night, Roy, and thank you for another great net. And looking forward to the next one. This is Kilo Golf 2 Charlie. 7-3, everyone.